Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm your host, Pat Johnston, and wow, we're about to reach the month of April. Is that right? Seems like 2019 is kind of flying by, which might not necessarily be a bad thing. You know, this is the coolest month of the year because it is your esteemed host birthday month. I just thought I'd throw that out there. In between the weekly podcasts, you can always visit the LOL site, which is leftoflansing.com. You can follow me on Twitter, which is at leftoflansing. We are also on the Facebook as well. The weekly podcast is available online at leftoflansing.com. Plus, it's available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio Public, plus much more. There are many ways that you can listen to the weekly podcast that is devoted to highlighting the progressive change that is happening right here in the state of Michigan. Yes, there's all kinds of bad news happening across the country, mostly because of President Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Yes, there's all kinds of bad news that's happening worldwide, in part because of Donald Trump, but maybe the progressive change that we are witnessing that's happening right now here in the state of Michigan could serve as perhaps a blueprint for the rest of the country in the future. And that is what this podcast is all about. Coming up, Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News will be joining me here on LOL. Now, Ingrid's a conservative, and we are going to talk about if universities are truly trying to muzzle conservative speech. And we might actually find some common ground on perhaps changing how we elect presidents through the Electoral College. So that is coming up here in just a few moments. Man, it's been quite a week already, hasn't it? I mean, I could really use a Bell's Oberon beer at this moment. I mean, Oberon Day passed just a few days ago, and I didn't even get to celebrate it yet. I'm hoping to do that right after I'm done with this podcast. That is serving as my reward for finishing up this week's podcast. You know, my wife and I, we love watching the classic TV show MASH just to wind down from time to time. In fact, I think she uses it more as escapism from the madness that is happening everywhere in the world right now. Now, we saw an episode last weekend in which a chopper pilot pays local South Korean children to scrounge around minefields for souvenirs. And sometimes these children get severely hurt. You know, they lose a leg or an arm. But the pilot just doesn't seem to have 1 ounce of empathy for them, just as long as they retrieve those souvenirs so he can make a buck selling them to anyone who wants them. Now, the show's protagonist, Dr. Hawkeye Pierce, played by the indelible Alan Alda, and B.J. Honeycutt, played by the equally formidable Mike Farrell, develop a scheme to put this chopper pilot out of the souvenir business. They threaten to give him a bad physical, which would thereby ground him from his piloting duties. Now, whether or not that would really work in real life, probably not. And in terms of the show, it's not real ethical, but I guess that's MASH. That's a major theme of MASH, that it's kind of blurring the ethical line in the middle of the madness of war. So, anyway, the pilot agrees to quit his business, but he tells them that while they may have stopped him, there are other pilots doing just the same stuff. So what are they going to do? Clean up all of Korea, he asks? To which BJ snaps back, no, just our little corner of it. Now, that line stuck with me this weekend after President Trump's attorney general released a 4-page summary of the Mueller report. While never quoting one full sentence from the report, Attorney General Bill Barr wrote that Mueller could not find criminal evidence that Trump or the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government. However, on the issue of obstruction of justice, Barr wrote that Trump was neither guilty or exonerated on that charge. We are still, 1 week later, waiting on that report. And I think it behooves congressional Democrats to bring Barr and Mueller in front of committees to answer questions. And I'm still wondering when we are going to get that report. Why do I think it's going to take quite some time? Why do I think it might never actually see the light of day? Now, that being said, proving collusion was always going to be tough. Unless you had a video showing Trump and Putin devising a collusion scheme, Trump was never probably going to get charged with that crime. And I did notice last weekend how some liberals on social media were bummed out that more did not come out of the report. Well, I don't know. We still don't know what's in the report. Regardless, I think that there was some hoping that Trump would be handcuffed and shoved into a police car on the White House's front lawn. But while we know Trump obviously obstructed justice and obviously had some dealings with Russian officials and businessmen through the years, I didn't feel as hopeless as some of my fellow liberals out there. I didn't feel hopeless because I always knew that getting rid of Trump wasn't going to happen through Bob Mueller. No, it was going to happen through us. It has to happen through us. We have to vote him out in 2020. And I'm taking solace in the fact that while Trump and the Republicans are waging war against women's rights, Obamacare again, climate change, and now the Special Olympics, progressive change is taking place right here in Michigan. For example, last week, State Attorney General Dana Nessel continued to utilize the law to stifle efforts from those trying to discriminate against others. Back in 2017, Christie and Dana Dumont were denied the chance to adopt a child through St. Vincent Charities and Bethany Christian Services. Now, Republicans and former Governor Rick Snyder passed a law, if you recall, back in 2015, preventing the state from telling those agencies that they had to provide adoption services regardless if it conflicted with their religious beliefs. But that did not deter the Dumonts. No, on the contrary, that emboldened them. With the help of the American Civil Liberties Union, the Dumonts sued the state for discrimination. Now, the state adoption agencies filed a motion to have the case dismissed, but that motion was denied by a district judge. So thanks to last year's elections, thanks to all of us who went out and voted, thanks to all of us who decided to use our vote in 2018, much-needed sweeping changes are happening. Because Attorney General Nessel decided that according to her reading of that hateful statute, the state would possibly lose and still be liable. She directed a settlement with the plaintiffs, saying the Dumonts were illegally discriminated against. And according to Michigan Advance, the settlement says that the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services agrees to maintain federally required non-discrimination provisions in its foster care and adoption agency contracts, which will allow the couple in question and all other qualified families to adopt from state contracted agencies regardless of their sexual orientation. So Nessel's settlement essentially bans foster care and adoption agencies that accept state contracts from denying same-sex couples looking to adopt. Of course, those agencies that don't accept state money can still discriminate, citing religious objections. Hopefully that can be changed someday. But still, regardless, this is huge news, and it's welcome news. I've never understood how people claiming to work for faith-based foster care agencies could object to helping same-sex couples adopt a child. I mean, the goal is to find a child a loving and caring home, is it not? These faith-based institutions keep imploring women to refuse abortions and to put their children up for adoption. Fine. I won't argue with that. But then when it comes to adoption, only certain people can adopt. Huh. Now, of course, they can't cite one passage in which Jesus ever said one negative word about homosexuality, but they can still cite religious objections. Well, thankfully, it's great to have an attorney general who is truly fighting for children. You know, like Jesus did. Let's also look in Lansing, where Mayor Andy Shore announced this week that Lansing will become the first city to completely use renewable energy as a way to address climate change. The City Pulse reports that by July 1st, Lansing is expected to power every government building using energy from 100% renewable sources. Oh, I mean, that's huge! Again, this is a first step, but it's a step. Other cities across Michigan have made similar commitments as well, like Ann Arbor, but Lansing is the first to actually do it. All right, here's another. Governor Whitmer this week ordered the Department of Environmental Quality to begin the process of determining drinking water standards for PFAS in our state's water systems. PFAS, again, are those toxic, hazardous, potentially cancerous chemicals that are being found in water systems throughout the state. And thanks to years and years and years of deregulation by conservatives, Michiganders throughout the state are drinking toxic water. Now, we've been waiting and waiting for the federal government to set a standard, but Gretchen Whitmer can't wait any longer. and she wants something done now to protect her fellow Michiganders. We can't wait for the Trump administration, which of course is bought off by industries and corporations, to do something. We can't wait. And thankfully, Governor Whitmer is showing leadership on this issue. Here's another. Every time I drive home from work, I get to see all those windmill farms in Gratiot and Isabella counties. I mean, that serves as a sign of the future for energy here in Michigan, and I didn't go blind from light flicker or lose my mind. I mean, these are just some of the things that are happening right now, right here in our state. Yes, Donald Trump and his Republican allies are making a mess of things, and it can sometimes make us feel overwhelmed. It can make us feel despondent, and it can make us feel depressed. I know, I hear you. But here in Michigan, we have true progressive leaders who are doing their best to press on, who are doing their best to change things for the better. You could say that thanks to progressive leadership, Michigan is doing what it can to clean up its own little corner of the country.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. Upset with something you've heard? Did Pat say something you think is ignorant, stupid, or arrogant? Or do you actually agree with something Pat said on the podcast? Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
Welcome back to the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm Pat Johnston. And remember, you can visit the blog leftoflansing.com for more news and information and maybe even some entertainment from time to time. Joining me right now is Ingrid Jacques. She is the deputy editorial page editor with the Detroit News. Ingrid, first of all, thanks a lot for joining the podcast. I want you to know that I've read your stuff for a long time. I've really appreciated some of the stuff that you've written, even though I disagree with you about 80% of the time. But I like reading what you have to say because you make me think. You know, it would just get boring just reading people that you agree with or reading publications that you agree with all the time. And I just want to thank you for everything that you do at the Detroit News. You do some good stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, first of all, you are originally from Oregon. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I said that correctly, right? It's not Oregon. It's Oregon, right?
No, you said it right.
Okay. Well, how'd you
make... Well done. Not everyone does that in Michigan.
How did you make it out to Michigan eventually?
I've been in Michigan now more than half my life, full-time. I came out to go to college. I went to Hillsdale, a small liberal arts school in southern Michigan, and ended up meeting a Michigan guy and stuck around.
Yes, that's sometimes how it goes. That's
right. Even though I missed Oregon and the mountains and my family, but, you know,
we have hills and lakes here.
Oh, that's true. No, I've grown to love Michigan as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we're going to talk about some of your articles here that you've written here recently, especially the one regarding the Electoral College, because I think that's where you and I do find some common ground there, and you do have an interesting take on that issue. But first, I was wondering if we could talk about the lack of, or what I sometimes would say, the supposed lack of free speech on college campuses. In your piece titled, Trump is Not the Fix for Free Speech on the Quad, you wrote about how some University of Michigan students protested when conservative activist Ben Shapiro, right, showed up there to speak on the campus?
Yeah, and I added that in because it was, you know, recent news hook. It wasn't the biggest protest that's ever happened on U of M campus, but it was a tie-in to what President Trump promised at CPAC this year, that he went on for like 13 minutes or so in the speech saying how he was going to crack down on what he saw as the lack of free speech on many college campuses, which I'd agree with him there, but he took it a step too far, in my opinion, to say that he was going to issue this executive order to basically make sure that public universities were ensuring free speech on their campuses. And he did end up following through on that since I wrote this piece. And he did keep it pretty narrow as far as the impact. It could potentially be research dollars going to universities at risk if universities in question aren't following through. So he did keep it narrow, but I thought that really wasn't his place to be issuing an executive order here. The First Amendment already offers enough protections I believe. I think it's an important discussion to have, that there are these issues happening, especially for conservative young people on a lot of public university campuses. There's plenty of stories out there, but I just didn't think Trump was the answer here.
So that's sort of, you're sticking with your conservative values there, in that you think that sometimes the answer isn't always something that is passed by the federal government.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And I feel like there's plenty of protection already within the Constitution, within the First Amendment. And it's one thing to call attention to a problem and another for the president to sort of dictate policy in this way to get even further involved. And it just makes me uneasy.
We're speaking with Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Ingrid, is it really an issue? Do you really believe that conservatives and conservative students are being muzzled on university campuses throughout the country?
I think so. I do. I think it happens in a variety of ways. Often, I believe, unintentional from probably well-meaning administrators that intend to really open up their campuses and, you know, open up to diversity and ideas. They end up closing off certain ideas in the process. I highlighted a year ago, I wrote about, again, the University of Michigan. They have this bias response team designed by the administration that basically it encourages students to really kind of spy on each other. Anything, say, a student overhears that they perceive to be biased or insensitive or however it may offend them, they can go report that, and then the offending student is investigated and potentially faces discipline or more. And it's just, you know, that's just one instance. And you also hear a lot about on campuses in Michigan and around the country when, say, a conservative group brings in a speaker. There have been a lot of cases where that speech can't even happen for whether safety concerns because of the escalations of the protests or students who don't like a speaker coming in and yelling and shouting. And so that, in effect, quashes that speech.
And I do agree with you that some of those students who would consider themselves liberal sometimes do their party a disadvantage by protesting conservative speakers who show up, because in a way that I always argue that they're giving those conservative speakers what they want, which is publicity. And if they would just let them speak, then everything would just be fine. Everybody's lives would be fine. So, and it's vice versa, too. When conservatives will protest a liberal speaker at certain places, maybe
oh,
not
sure.
on campuses,
no,
but
it can,
wherever.
It can go both ways, sure. And I mean, that's a First Amendment right to protest and, you know, make your concerns known. But when it gets to the point that it's preventing other speech from happening and these campuses aren't really doing enough to monitor their campus environments and make sure, you know, a wide variety of ideas are being heard, then that's when it crosses the line into a problem.
And that's why I was wondering, I remember, I think it was maybe about a year ago, I think it was when Scott Walker was still the governor of Wisconsin. I think it was the Wisconsin University Board of Regents. They passed a rule that ordered students that they would be expelled if they interrupted the speech of another student three times. I was wondering, how did you feel about that? Isn't that sort of the reverse? And that you're muzzling the free speech of somebody else?
Yeah, I mean, right, you got to be careful. I've written about Michigan last year was looking at passing similar legislation to what they did in Wisconsin, and there's a handful of other states that are trying to address this in their legislatures. And I also, much like I did with this executive order, even though I'm empathetic
right.
to the problem, I thought these bills also took it too far, because they basically called for stricter disciplinary measures against students who do protest. And I thought that was a bit much. Again, the First Amendment offers enough protections. And I think campuses do need leeway in monitoring their own environments and creating their campus cultures. But I do think it's important for people to know what's going on these campuses, especially since, in the case of public universities, quite a few tax dollars are going there. So I think taxpayers have a right to know what's happening. The best way is just drawing attention to when there are problems and when speech is being silenced. That needs to be known. And in the case of U of M, they got a federal lawsuit based on this bias response team and some other measures they'd had, and they've taken measures to kind of bring some of those more in line.
Did anybody get turned in by this response team that was set up by the University of Michigan?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, people did?
Oh, sure.
And did they get investigated?
Hundreds. Oh, yeah.
The students got investigated?
Yes.
And
were
they punished?
I think some were sanctioned. I don't think it got so bad as they got expelled or kicked out. But I talked with this group, Speech First, that brought the lawsuit, and their concern was this happens enough times, students know about it. It's a preemptive silencing of speech. Just the fact that it exists, and the students are going to really monitor what they're saying anywhere they could possibly be overheard. So it's a chilling effect on sort of that robust campus dialogue.
Okay. Well, we are speaking with Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News here on the Left of Lansing podcast. And boy, I think we could just have an interview on college free speech. That would last long
really
enough.
Interesting.
It is. It is. And I've only got you for a couple more minutes. So I just wanted to ask you about your recent article that you wrote about the Electoral College. It was titled "Dems Are Partly in parentheses, right about Electoral College." What part are Democrats like Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts getting right, would you say, when it comes to maybe getting rid of the Electoral College, or at least trying to focus more on the majority vote when it comes to presidential elections?
Sure. I thought she was partly right last week at a rally. She made a comment that every vote matters and made some comments about how we needed to shift more to a popular vote. I'll say more about that in a second, but where I disagree with her is on this concept of nationalizing elections, and she wants to outright get rid of the Electoral College, which would be very difficult, take a constitutional amendment, of course, and fundamentally change how our founders saw how the process working. And that makes me uneasy. But there's another kind of competing way to look at this.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? It's the National Vote State Compact. Is that the name of it?
Yeah, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is the formal name. And this effort's been going on for years, really. But it's been gaining momentum. And the way it would work, their advocates say that it's a way to get to a popular vote while preserving the Electoral College. That is because if enough states, this is a state legislature, each state has to pass a law saying they want to join the compact. And when enough states equaling the 270 electoral votes sign on, the number that you need to win a presidential election, then the idea is that a national popular vote would go into effect. But each state would still run its own elections, which would not happen if elections were nationalized. And I think that would create all kinds of messes. So you preserve the state's involvement. States can opt out at any time if they decide it's not working well for them. Supposedly, this is all within the bounds of the Constitution and Electoral College. It's just the states have the right to decide how they want to allocate their electoral votes, and by joining this compact, that's how they're choosing to do that. But it's really fascinating to me. Anytime I write about this issue, I get probably more feedback on this than anything else. Like, people really care about this issue both ways, and any effort to change how things are now is often seen as going against the foundation of this founding document in our Constitution. I've really looked into it, and I don't think that's true.
Well, all right, so if I get this right, what happens right now, of course, is that states send their Electoral College winner to the candidate who wins their state, usually. Now, this compact, if a state becomes part of this group, that would erase how we are commonly doing the practice right now. And would that take power out of the state's hands? Let's say, for instance, let's say Hillary Clinton would have won. Here we go. She won the national vote. So if Michigan was part of this compact, would that mean that they would have had to give all of their electoral votes to Hillary Clinton since she won the national vote?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If enough states sign on. So currently there's 12 states, and Washington, D.C. have passed laws to join this compact. There's still 89 electoral votes shy of this going into effect. So if enough states equaling 270 electoral votes sign on, we'd automatically go to this national popular vote model. So regardless of whether a state signed on to the compact or not, they would have to award their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. So, like we talked about, I'm from Oregon, and this concept really hit home for me because, you know, say in Oregon, I grew up in a conservative family, but it's been decades since Oregon has voted for a Republican presidential candidate. So you could say, you know, in Oregon, if you're a conservative, your vote hasn't really mattered in a long time because there's really no way that Oregon's going to go.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Conservative.
I see where you're going with this. Then maybe that way, if you're a Republican voter in Oregon, you mm-hmm. could say my vote might actually count this time if the Republican wins the national vote.
Exactly, because you're sort of broken apart from your state per se. So your vote matters regardless of what the overall population of the state is going to do. So, I mean, of course, the argument against a national popular vote has always been, oh, well, presidential candidates will just spend all their time on the coast in the big cities. They're just going to skip over the rest of the country. But, I mean, really, what's the stat I saw recently? The five largest cities in the U.S. only constitute about 6% of the overall population. That's not a real accurate argument to say the candidates would only spend their time there. And if you look at it now, the vast majority of all the campaigning currently is done in the 12
right.
battleground
yes,
quote,
exactly.
swing states. So we're already, there's a lot of the country that is getting passed over.
Ingrid, what kind of feedback are you getting from your fellow conservatives when you wrote this article?
As a whole, they don't like it. They do not like this idea. They want to keep things as is because they feel like any kind of meddling with the current system is going against what the founders wanted. And most Republicans, a lot of conservatives, that idea goes against the grain. But what's fascinating with this national popular vote effort, the folks that are really advocating it, it's split evenly between Republicans and Democrats.
And that's same here in Michigan, too, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
I mean, Republicans.
There were bills last year, right, that were introduced in the state legislature?
Yeah, the one in the Senate had, I think, 15 Republican senators signed on and 10 Democrats. So, I mean, that's pretty rare to see that much
yes, it is.
Bipartisan support. If you talk to a Republican politician and a Democratic politician, you'll get very different reasons why they would support this. But overall, it just seems to me to be the most fair way to do this. So.
We're speaking with Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News. Just one last question, and I know this isn't exactly what we talked about before the show, but I just wanted your honest take here. What do you think conservatives or Republicans have to do in order to get women voters back on their side? Because as we've seen, especially here in Michigan, Democrats are enjoying a substantial majority of the women's vote. What do you think conservatism has done to push women to the more progressive side and to push them towards progressive candidates and ideas?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, that's definitely something I've thought a lot about. And I mean, as a party, Republicans are not doing a good job with bringing in women and even keeping women who had been voting Republican in past years. And we saw that in Michigan with a lot of women that had voted Republican in the past, especially in the suburbs. They didn't this last time. So Republicans are really going to have to work hard with their messaging and going to work to recruit back some of these women that had served as a part of the base. And I've not really heard any great ideas so far from the national or the state party. I mean, we have a woman now, again, as head of the Michigan Republican Party, and I have a lot of respect for Laura Cox, but she's all about trying to get more women to run, but for her, it's more about finding the best candidate, and she is 100% committed to reelecting President Trump. And I think,
is that the roadblock? Do you think is that the curse?
Well, is that the hurdle? I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, as a state party chair, you're going to have to, you know, probably sign on to do that. But I've written the state party especially really needs a more probably nuanced recruiting tool to bring back some of these women who just, it's not just women, obviously there's a lot of conservatives who want nothing to do with Trump, mm-hmm. you know, who believe he's hurting the party and he's not fundamentally conservative. So I have not seen any great paths forward on that question. It's alarming. It's something that the national party is very aware of. And I think it would help a lot if Republicans could do a better job of putting some youthful, exciting women candidates out there. I mean, I know they exist within the party, but we're just not doing a good job recruiting them and getting them to run and kind of show a new face or a different face to the Republican Party.
Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News. She is the deputy editorial page editor. Thank you very much for being on. It was nice to finally get to talk with you, and I hope that you'll consider coming back on the podcast sometime again in the future.
Yeah, definitely. I enjoyed it. Thanks, Pat.
That was a good discussion. And while we do disagree, I think it was kind of cool that Ingrid and I were able to find some common ground, especially on the issue of the Electoral College and fixing the Electoral College a little bit. And one more point, we didn't have time to bring this up when we were discussing the whole issue of free speech on college campuses, but I found this one point funny. As we were talking about President Trump's whole executive order demanding that colleges allow freedom of speech, demanding that colleges allow conservatives to speak on college campuses, allowing conservatives to have a voice on campus. This week, President Trump and his lawyers were in court over whether or not if he had the right to block certain individuals from his personal Twitter account. Irony is dead.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. Don't forget, you can contact Pat by emailing leftoflansing@gmail.com and visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information.
Special thanks again to Ingrid Jacques from the Detroit News for joining me here on the LOL podcast this week. Remember, you can email me. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com and visit leftoflansing.com as I have provided links to Ingrid's Detroit News page filled with all of her writings. You know, there's one part of our discussion that gave me hope, and that is that I think it is possible that maybe our state legislature could pass a bill that would allow us to join the interstate voting compact thing that we were talking about that would give the majority of Americans more of a voice in their elections. The majority picks the winner in state elections and local elections. Why not in our national election, in our presidential election? We don't say, well, just because Governor Whitmer won big in the highly populated areas of Michigan doesn't mean that she should have won the 2018 election. No, we don't say that because that would be stupid. We should pick leaders by counting human beings who vote. We should not pick presidents based on land acreage. All right, time for the Left of Lansing last call. Republicans are pouncing all over Gretchen Whitmer's proposed 45-cent gas tax increase to help fix the damn roads. I even heard a story where some Republicans are pushing to bring just her gas tax proposal to the state legislature floors for a vote. It's a very Mitch McConnell type of move. It's a gimmick, but that's what Republicans rely on since they have no fresh ideas of their own. They're all about trying to own the libs. That's all they've got nowadays is, oh, let's own the libs. No, we don't have any ideas, but let's own the libs. We have no solutions, so let's rip on them for their proposed solutions. Yes, gas prices are pretty high right now in certain areas around the state, especially in the central and northern regions, where prices are hovering around $2.90 a gallon. And with prices that high, I can understand why opponents of any kind of gas tax would believe they've got the upper hand in the debate. But then I suddenly had a thought. You know, speaking of the lack of Republican ideas, they did have an idea a few years ago, and it was that all we had to do was drill, baby, drill, and then we'd see our gas prices drop forever. Well, they got their wish, and yet gas prices keep rising. But wait a second. I was promised that gas prices would drop if we just drill more oil here in the country. Are you trying to tell me that the oil and gas industry and the numerous politicians that they buy have been lying to us through all these years? They've been lying to us? No way! Next thing you're going to tell me is that Republicans really don't care about people with pre-existing conditions losing their health care. I mean, they promised us that they would always fight for people with pre-existing conditions. And yet, the Trump administration is fighting to have the court strike down the Affordable Care Act, which protects people with pre-existing conditions. And like Michigan Republicans who have no plan to fix the roads, Trump and congressional Republicans have no plan to make healthcare more affordable and effective for people. In fact, if Trump and Republicans get their way in the courts, hundreds of thousands of Michiganders will lose healthcare coverage through the Medicaid expansion. Why do I get the feeling that Republicans only care about getting cheap shots into their opponents rather than finding real solutions to help people? I don't know. Maybe because it's true?
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wanderbeats. To hear more, visit wanderbeats.net. That's wanderbeats.net. Now back to Pat Johnston.
If you recall, I promised myself that if I made it through this podcast, my reward would be an Oberon beer. My first of the year, a Bell's Oberon beer. And I've got the bottle right here. So I'm opening the bottle, and now I'm pouring it into my Central Michigan glass because I'm a CMU grad, of course. Oh, that looks just delicious. Okay, here we go. First sip of the year of Oberon beer for your esteemed host, Pat Johnston. Here we go. That's going to do it for this edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm now going to enjoy the rest of my Oberon, maybe two, maybe three, maybe four. But I'll be back with another installment of the Left of Lansing podcast next week. You can always email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Remember, take the battle to them. I'm Pat Johnston. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information and Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.